Hello and welcome to Reptoid Screenings, episode 101. I'm your host, Em, and with me are my regular co-host, Jackson.
Hello.
And Destiny.
Hey.
Destiny's sick, so excuse any sniffles that are going to happen.
Please forgive me.
We're already 2 weeks late because everyone was sick last time. and Destiny's still sick this time, so so it goes. Bad. It's movie time. Jackson, I know you've seen a movie.
I've seen a movie, yeah. I've seen a bunch of anime nonsense for the other podcast, but I've seen a real last movie.
Yeah.
I watched Gladiator last night.
Dad movie classic.
Yeah, dad movie classic. Didn't really like it very much.
That got best picture.
That's crazy. No, it's not. I understand why it got best picture. That's why I don't like it. That's why it's not one of Ridley's best.
He'd like make I've never seen it.
Hannibal right after, and he'd get back to what matters, which is some stupid shit with a guy in Italy.
Here's the thing, is Hannibal is also a mess. I would not say Hannibal is like a fantastic motion picture.
No, but it's fun. It's yes. The ways it is bad are chaotic and ridiculous. The yes. ways the Gladiator are bad are morose and generic.
Okay, I haven't seen Gladiator literally in like 15, 20 years. I wanted you to watch it because it's just like a touchstone that is worth referencing as like a thing.
It was important to me to have seen it because we're doing Kingdom of Heaven.
For Blockbusters in like 2 weeks.
For Blockbusters in like 2 weeks, yeah. And it's impossible to talk about that without talking about Gladiator on some level as the other big, really historical touchstone of the times. Don't need to also watch Robin Hood, thank God.
I mean, I want to watch Robin Hood. I bet it's fun.
It's probably better than this because I like Russell Crowe. He's having a good time. But like, so it's this big, you know, epic historical piece. But they were rewriting the script all the time, and they narrowed the plot down to the most pat. Like, it's all about his family. His family got burned alive, and he's revenge for his family. But it's also kind of about he wants revenge for the idea of Rome as a republic, which he wants to restore, because Marcus Aurelius also wanted to restore the republic, which is not really true. And the way
Nobody knew anything about Rome in the year 2000. You could say whatever you want.
That's not true. It's based on real history. And like at the end, when they're all like Derek Jacobi, the power passes back to the people. I'm like, well, then what happened? Like, you know, it's the year of the five emperors next. It's a bad time. You know, people, the audience.
Podcasts didn't even exist. No one was getting pop history fed to them through YouTube. YouTube didn't exist. No one knew anything about Rome.
Yeah, you had to be actually go and read a fucking book. You couldn't listen to that one guy do the history of Rome.
Yeah.
At the time.
I'm just saying that the number of people who read history books versus the number of people who claim to be into history, radically different numbers.
Yes. And yes, like pop history podcast specifically changed the dynamic of how many people know about what happened in Rome, right?
Yes.
Right.
I'm not saying it's a problem with that it's like historically inaccurate, but I do think the changes just present a worldview that's kind of boring. It's absolutely about reckoning with like the American Empire as this like it's about like a troop that maintains the frontier, right?
Yes.
Who wants to go home, but at home there's like corruption and the politicians are all feckless and
pre-9/11 ideology is happening.
Yeah, some extremely pre-9/11 ideology is happening, just kind of supplanted onto Rome. But it's also all about the family and this like little love triangle they've got going on, because it's just like, you know, screenplay advice, make everything personal so everyone understands what's going on, and that's why it wins an Oscar, because the dads are watching him like, oh, yes, I also would want revenge for my son. Whereas I'm thinking, this is stupid to hang this, like, political, historical epic on the most, like, completely hacked John Wick shit imaginable. Oh, he killed his wife and son. Oh, no. Like, obviously, you'd be fucked up by that. I'm not like, it wouldn't be believable that he'd be mad.
John Wick did not invent a dead wife and son. And John Wick's not even about that, to be fair.
Dead no, but it is playing with that intentionally as like a, this is kind of a bit, right? It is a bit to do this in a movie to hinge your entire motivation on characters that don't exist outside of flashbacks where they look nice and go, ooh.
At the, he touches the wheat also, excuse you, he touches the wheat.
He touches the wheat and then he touches the wheat later and it's dark and the lighting's off.
Yeah. You have no capacity for joy in your heart, is all I'm saying.
What the fuck? I have lots of capacity for joy. That's the thing, is like, I do like guys in meetings standing up for honor or whatever. Like, I would say that I preferred the first 50 minutes, where it's all the stuff with Marcus Aurelius and like you and my son that I should have had. And it's literally just Game of Thrones, exactly 100% just Game of Thrones. He's Ned Stark. It's like, I'm being summoned by my king to do this thing because I'm the most noble one because I don't want to. And then I get betrayed in this world of espionage or whatever. That stuff works better for me than the gladiator stuff, which I found much more tedious.
He fights a giant and a tiger at the same time. It's pretty cool.
I thought the action scenes were kind of bad because I'm like, oh, I didn't realize
well,
that.
Yes, yeah, this like, is weird. They were literally like, no one has learned from the Matrix yet to get a real fight choreographer.
He has learned from fucking Save It Private Ryan. And I'm like, it's weird because it's not full on post-born shaky cam, right? Where it's all like handheld verite action scenes, but it is still like, it's the camera's upside down now and you can't really see what's going on.
You know, what movie is a Sword and Sandals movie that has lots of highly choreographed action scenes?
Is it Troy?
It's Troy! It's fucking Troy!
Classic of cinema, Troy.
Yes, I love Troy.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe I was just rushing it in a bad mood. I didn't think I was in a bad mood. I was in a fine mood yesterday. I was enjoying parts
I Googled Gladiator screenshot and I saw the big giant guy who fights with the tiger who has the big like mask, like just the like metal mask of a human face. And I'm like, this guy's fucking cool.
I also have, I like don't find the aesthetics of Rome cool.
I would not say I'm a Rome sicko, but I do like when big guys are in ornate armor.
Yeah. And I also don't like, I just realized, I don't really like the gladiator side of gladiator. I'm not really, like the part where it's also like a death game, the people are brought together in this prison movie thing. I think that's like totally fine. It's just I'm not as aesthetically into it as I am like the tragic noble commander leading his like weary troops stuff at the start, right? That's just like, not even as a like quality thing, as a pure taste thing. One of those appeals to me more than the other, unsurprisingly with my history of what movies I like. But yeah, you know, it was not one of my preferred Ridley movies down the bottom of my Ridley list. I haven't, like, so I've only seen about 9 according to Letterboxd, but I didn't like as much of the other ones I've seen. So
best Ridley movie, go.
Best Ridley movie. I've only seen 9, but
of the ones you've seen, what's the best one?
Fucking Alien.
Okay.
Probably I would have to rewatch Blade Runner to see. I thought Blade Runner was good. But not amazing.
My money's on Legend. Fucking Legend.
Have not seen Legend.
Oh, yeah. Legend rules.
I've seen Blade Runner, Alien, The Martian, Prometheus, Alien Covenant, Hannibal, American Gangster, Gladiator, and Body of Lies.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not like the greatest spread of Ridley films, but it is a spread, I guess. It's 9 movies. That's some movies.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd say Alien, easily. Alien.
Okay.
It's a good movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. I'm not here to say it's not. Destiny, you've got some films.
I saw a couple of films. I saw Love Lies Bleeding.
How's that?
Rose Glasses film. I thought it was so good. It's like one of those movies where it's like watching a slow motion car crash. You're just like, this is going to go real bad. And it does. And it's like, oh, everybody kept saying, like, all my friends were like, oh, it's kind of like a girl power movie. I'm like, nah, too dark to be a girl power movie. It was way more like a lesbian version of The Wrestler, where you're just like, oh, this person's fucked. This is doomed. Everybody's really good in it. Katie O'Brien, can't say enough good stuff about her. Ed Harris eats a bug, and I'll never forget it.
Okay.
And then I saw Late Night with the Devil, which was also quite good. There are some things about it, like, it's a found footage movie, but a lot of the, like, oh, we have this footage of this late night show that was really popular in the 70s, kind of a cult thing, lost episode that aired, and it's like, the conceit only goes, like, it only works for a little bit. After that, it stops being believable. But, and a lot of people were hung up on that, but I don't know, I liked it. I'm sad about the AI art thing that everybody was talking about.
Wait, what do you mean people are hung up on it? I'm very curious, because you go to movies with very normal people, normies, yes, if you will.
Well, the normies that I went with were like, after the movie, they were like, oh, that was AI art? Why did they do that?
No, about the thing about the found footage. You said people were hung up on it.
I guess. Yeah, like...
I just want to know what you meant by that.
Oh, I just mean, like, the believability that there would be a lost episode of this, like, wildly popular show, and then also that they would have, like, the behind-the-scenes footage. Like, who's filming that? Like, the logistics just kind of fall apart. That's all
I meant. A lot of people are. I don't know. I feel like it's weird, because I think that makes a lot of sense in, like, a... In a world in which analog horror is really popular on people who are younger than all of us, like by a generation, right? You get a lot of like, mm-hmm. this looks like a faux public access show because the people making it never lived at a time where public access shows are real. It's like all legendary to them anyway. It doesn't matter, right? The aesthetics of that thing are inherently alien by their nature, so they can do whatever they want. And it does, like, no one's thinking, oh, why would they be filming backstage at a studio television show? Even though there's plenty of footage of backstage of television shows in the world. I don't know. I think that's one of those things where you only ask questions when you're old enough to remember when that stuff was real.
Oh, I know. I just, like, one of the main Letterboxd reviews I saw was just somebody going off about the found footage part. And I was like, eh. And they also were, like, bitching about the effects, but I thought the effects were fine. There was actually a really cool thing near the end of the movie that I was like, oh, that's neat. And I will admit, like, all exorcist-y type, like, possession movies have the same beats, and this movie is no different.
Yeah.
But I still, like, the acting is, like, amazing, and the way that it feels like a 70s talk show are very genuine. I really enjoyed that. So overall, I liked it. I had very few problems with it, but like I said, like, my friend who's an artist kept saying, it would have been really fun for a human person to make that art that they replaced with, or they used AI for, and it's like, well, yeah, that's true. Why would they... Like, what's the point? It's just very
cheaper.
Dumb.
It's cheaper. That's the point.
It's just sad.
Also, a lot of, like, it's... I would not say this is true for everything, but let me tell you, it spread... I was aware of this movie existing that was a very small movie, right? Like, yes. I'm not saying it was inherently a marketing angle, but... It became a talking point that you had to have an opinion on this movie that I think otherwise would have gone completely under the radar, right? Like,
I mean, horror people would have found it because horror people find everything.
I'm not saying it would have had no audience, right? But like, it absolutely got a awareness and PR, like, advertising bump off of this controversy in a way that is a shame because that's just what, like, a controversy does.
Oh, yeah. And it's like, oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I think that's, like, inherently cynical was the intention, or that, like, all AI art thing intended to, like, get free advertising off a bunch of headlines about AI art. I just think this one happened to be at the right, like, awareness level to benefit from that.
I'm not going to disagree there. And it's only, like, 3 seconds of AI art. Like, that's the part that bums me out the most. Like, 3 seconds of footage. It's, like, not anything. They could have paid for that. Anyway. I did enjoy it. Out of the two, I think I preferred Love Lies Bleeding because I just like gay human misery stories.
That's true. That's
my wheelhouse. More than I like possession movies, but yeah, good times.
So I have, since in the month since we recorded, watched like 17 movies. I'm not going to talk about all of them. Some of them I talked about on Around the Long Fire, which is my classics podcast, my friend Neve, where we talk about movies sometimes. You'd like to hear me talk about Agnès Varda's Murmur and Documentour and the Senegalese movie Tuki Buki. Please check out the last two episodes of Around the Long Fire. Actually, one episode from last week and the episode that'll come out tomorrow as this podcast goes out about those things. So I will not talk about any of that stuff. So I've been just like watching a lot of stuff. I've been kind of sick and it was great. Criterion put up all of Isabella Rossellini's like short animal history, like zoology movies, which are her in a bunch of like paper craft costumes talking about the mating habits of animals that she made for like 15 years.
Green porno.
Yeah, it starts with green porno, but goes into a couple other things. Because she was like, we called it green porno because it was like Robert Redford asked me to do these things because he was doing the Sundance stuff. And he was big on green things. It was green this, green that. So I said, the one thing he doesn't have is green porno. So I'm going to call it green porno. And she's like, but then we had to sell it to other people. And you can't sell a thing called porno. They won't buy it. especially the other ones are called other, they have different names. But there's a bunch of them on Criterion. It's really good. because she just, once she stopped being a model, she just went and studied animal behavior in college. She was like, I guess I'll just do something for me, and then made these shorts, and they're all very good, and they're all there. I highly recommend them. And then Criterion also had the Razzies collection of famously derided movies. I would not say bad movies, because some of them, I'm like Showgirls is just a fucking classic. People are out of their minds. But the one on that I most wanted to see, because people have strong opinions about it, was 2001 Tom Green classic Freddy Got Fingered, which I watched. Which is it's like a really straightforward movie where Tom Green plays a guy who wants to be like an animator, like doing cartoons, and he has a bunch of art, but he's like too old and lives with his parents, who's Rip Torn, and his mom, who's the lady from that movie we saw, the Across America one where they sell their house, Destiny, what's her name?
Oh, Julie Haggerty.
Yeah, Julie Haggerty. She's great in it. And he's got like a younger brother who's like, I'm going to be a banker. And he goes and becomes a banker. It's like this ridiculous cartoon about this kind of burnout guy. Like Kevin Smith, 100 of these, and they're all really earnest. But this is like a weird send up of the like conservatism of the rom-com, basically, because like he goes, tries to get a job, can't get a job, has to move back in. Rip Torn treats him like shit. He gets a girlfriend who's his love interest, and she's like a lady in a wheelchair, and she just likes to fuck, and he's like, I'm really put off by your like aggressive sexuality. And she's like, oh, is it because I'm in a wheelchair? He's like, no, because all you want to do is blow me all the time. And it's like kind of a gross out movie. Like, it's famous for being gross out because that's Tom Green's thing, but I think the thing that works about it is just the way it pushes the framework of a romantic comedy into like absurdist spaces by just going really hard with like, these are the tropes, and we're just going to take them to the extreme. Like, it's just ridiculous. I really liked it. I ended up really liking it. I don't typically like this kind of humor. Like the gross out stuff. Like he like jerks off a horse in the first 5 minutes. Like, you know, Tom Green stuff happens. But the rest of it, I was like, there's like a lot of heart here. And I think it understands why the 90s had a bunch of these kind of movies, and they are all kind of bad and shitty in the same way, even though I like a lot of them. And it's like a genre that disappeared from the earth shortly after 2001. Or it's all folded into Netflix driven garbage, right? Like there's that fucking Irish movie that everyone claims is AI that hit with, what's her face? Everyone's talked about,
what movie?
The Lindsay Lohan one.
Yeah. The Lindsay Lohan one where I'll send you an article about it. How about that? Everyone else probably knows what I'm talking about.
Irish Wish.
Yes. That's what it's called.
What a title. That's like a Seinfeld title.
Yeah. And yeah, it just really hit me. I'm like, this is like really smart, and it has an amazing Ebert. Like Ebert fucking hated it, and then years later wrote a thing. He was like, I stand by everything I said. Not for me. Didn't like it, but I still think about it. And that's not true of a lot of movies I've ever talked about.
I love Ebert.
And that's how I feel about Freddy Got Fingered. I'm like, none of this feels like a thing that's my humor or like things that should work for me. But all put together, it like really hit. What the fuck?
Yeah, I was in the living room, and you were watching it in the bedroom, I believe, and yeah. I just kept hearing you laugh, and it was killing me, because I could not imagine you enjoying that movie at all, and I just kept hearing you laugh.
Yeah, I thought it was really funny. It worked.
Good.
I've not seen it, so it's always been like a weird object to me, because I hear it talked about as like this like unthinkable, absurdist, like it's so audacious in its bad taste, right?
I've watched movies that I think are like, I think your average John Waters movie has more things that I would describe as bad taste than this.
That's my thing, is I'm like, they have that, like, you know, they're about to fuck that horse in Clerks 2. Like this whole genre is like,
yes.
Yeah, like, it's pretty foul.
I've never known from the outside what, like, it's always been a mysterious black box to me, because I don't know what it could possibly contain that would make it crazier than the entire genre of this movie. Like down the
road. I don't think it's excessively outside of that realm. I think it's the zeal with which it constantly is pushing at the very staid framework of what these movies usually are, right? Mm-hmm. That works. That's the thing that works. Not that the whole thing is absurdist and like deconstructionist. It's mostly just like, you've seen a dozen of these, probably, no matter who you are, and we're just going to kind of poke at the structure, and it's going to be weird and goofy. And I think that's the thing. That it's like just smart about what movies are. It's not, I don't think it's like truly out there.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when it came out, because it was an MTV production, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't remember.
Oh, okay. Well, they advertised it heavily. Well, Tom Green was MTV's golden child a long time.
Sure.
And I watched the Tom Green Show religiously, but I thought the movie looked stupid. But the one thing that lives in my head rent-free from the trailer for this film is that Daddy, Would You Like Some Sausage song.
Oh, yeah.
In 2024, I will find myself humming it. I will find myself singing it. It just lives in my head rent-free.
Yeah. When he makes his fucking, because he makes his cartoon, like he finally sells the cartoon and becomes rich at some point in the movie, because of course he does. The cartoon is about basically his family, but they're all like zebras. They're all like zebra minotaurs from Africa. They're like a white family living in Africa. That's the gimmick. And he's like voicing himself, like his stand-in character. And it's like the most unwatchable garbage cartoon you've ever seen. But I was like, literally for the next 10 years, Adult Swim's going to make this exact cartoon, but earnestly.
Yeah.
And my friends loved every one of them. And I was like, these are fucking unwatchable.
Name three, please.
Yeah. Give me an example. Like a,
The Oblongs, Super Jail.
That's
okay,
not...
You made these up. I've never heard of these.
The Oblongs is not a Cartoon Network original.
I know, but that's where I saw it.
But Super Jail is great. I love Super Jail.
12 Ounce Mouse I liked, but it's one of these, right? It's just like fucking unwatchable on purpose.
Yeah, it is.
I googled The Oblongs. This looks like the almost the most like a fake thing I've ever seen. Like, the idea this was a real show that ran two seasons and not itself part of a movie that was a joke.
Yeah, I watched... It was only two seasons, but I've seen a lot
Ferrell,
of The Oblongs.
Will Ferrell led The Oblongs. Yeah, it's a fucking Gene weird Smart. Family comedy about a family that like lives in a town that has like nuclear pollution or whatever has made everyone deformed in some horrible way, and it's just like it's like The Simpsons basically,
but there's like a genre hook that doesn't actually do anything.
Yeah.
So like all there's like,
because he's called the Oblongs, so he doesn't have any limbs, he's just like a torso and a head.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, no, it's just a lot of that. Like, that's just the thing. I think it's like really, it's really on the pulse of where culture was at. That's a fucked up thing to say about Frigga Finger, but I think it's true. I think that's the stuff that works more than all the like big, elaborate, gross out humor is all.
Okay.
Yeah.
I also feel like Tom Green pales in comparison to a lot of the Jackass stunts.
Like, yeah, I've never watched Jackass. I've never seen Jackass. I don't.
Oh, okay, because like
the stunt, like I said, the stunts are the thing that I think is good about this movie. It's specifically the way at which pokes the genre and is really good about that.
Oh, I know. I'm just talking in general. Like when I think about the zeitgeist of Tom Green, everybody being like, "Oh, he humped dead animals in the road, and he would hump roadkill," and then I think about Jackass, and I'd be like, "It's the same thing." And they made five movies or six movies of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a bit like right early on where he goes to try to sell his cartoons, and the guy in Hollywood's like, you don't these don't show, you have to understand animals. You look, these pictures don't look like you understand anything about animals. And as he's driving home, he sees like a roadkill deer, and he stops his car and like goes and skins the deer and like walks around wearing the deer skin. And clearly they used a real deer carcass, and he's just like covered in gore, wearing the skin, trying to act like a deer, and people drive by. Yeah. Yeah, that's the stunt stuff, I guess. But like, I think the movie's just better, like more than just that stuff. I think it's just it's interesting.
Yeah, because that's the kind of stuff you do on his show.
Yeah,
so,
I like it for narrative reasons, narrative thematic reasons.
The narrative.
Anyway, the other movie, one of the other movies I watched is Kiana Skotsky, the 1982 documentary by Godfrey Reggio, which is about. Kiana Skotsky is one of those movies that I've always wanted to see. Destiny got me the trilogy for Christmas this year. I hadn't opened it up yet. And I popped in the first one. It's footage of America, both landscapes and cities. It like starts mostly in landscapes and then goes into like cities and manufacturing. And there's no dialogue or anything. It's just a famous Philip Glass score over time-lapse footage. It's like one of the things that really like push time lapses like a major narrative or like feature in film in America. Not that it didn't exist, but it really popularized using a lot of time lapse footage. And is like a meditation on modernity and society and culture that I think is like I loved it. I had a great time watching it. I think it might be an evil film.
Oh.
Is it like a intro to a Civilization game moded a little bit?
No, it's more like it presents like the modernization of the world as this, like, it's hard to Chaos Kasi itself is, let me see, it's a Hopi word, meaning crazy life, life in turmoil, life out of balance. And specifically, like, by juxtaposing images offers this, like, humanity arose out of a state of nature which has no morality to it, to be this big thing where everyone is living in gleaming cities and has all this technology, but also there's like homeless people, and look at it, and isn't it all like the base and the beautiful right next to each other, in this like weird moral ambivalence of like, what do you think about it? Is it horrible? Was it wonderful? But also it's like footage of like manufacturing lines in New York City as Americans build televisions, and I'm like, that's not a thing that exists right after this movie's made. Like, it glorifies this sort of like lifestyle of like working and upward mobility and consumerism that is unique to the early 80s, because by the late 80s it's fucking gone. None of those jobs exist anymore. The world is rapidly shifted away, but also it's just like lingers on like, these people are old. Isn't it weird to look at an old person on the street? And this is a homeless person. And isn't there like a weird beauty to their life compared to like the gleaming skyscrapers, as like the time lapse watches the skyscrapers slowly turn off as everyone leaves their offices and the lights go out. And they just sit right next to each other being like, what do you think of it? What do you think about it? It like shows big aerial shots of cities, but then it like jump cuts to like silicone chips. It's like, we are creating the new digital life out of our own image of our own organization into cities. And then goes back to like nature, which is radically different looking. And it just is like, it has this weird moral ambivalence about presenting these things in a way that I'm like, I think it's arrogant and ignorant.
This, okay. I haven't seen it. I kind of want to now that you've described it. But the thing that, like, my gut reaction to specifically what you're saying, whether it's true or not on my reading when I watch it, we'll see, I guess. But my gut reaction to your thing is, it just sounds like, is it an American movie?
They were working with the ACLU on, like, television spots and, like, ad campaigns about using like technology service announcements about like, you know, the new surveillance state in the 70s. And then they got a bunch of money and made this movie.
It just sounds like Americans get really, really shy about making some fucking propaganda, like Man with the Movie Camera, right?
Yeah.
Very same movie in some many ways compared to how you described it, but is directly, obviously, and earnestly about, this is the people together are strong, the people here is what they do, this is what the modern life looks like, this is what the modern life looks like when, like, the workers are put in industry together with purpose to build the new Russia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I think Kurosawa's Katsu would, I don't know, but I would assume the people making it would describe themselves as deeply skeptical of America, but not in any material way that we would recognize.
But it doesn't sound like, as described, it doesn't sound like it's doing anything but putting them into like a juxtaposition and going, ooh.
Yes, that is basically the thing I feel.
And I mean,
like, yes.
If you're making a, like, even a documentary that's like no narrative, or it's got a narrative, right? But like no direct voice, it's all images and juxtaposition, you can go harder than just putting things next to each other. I feel like it sounds like the discomfort you're having.
I wouldn't say it's discomfort, I just think it's a coward movie, but I loved it a lot. I thought it was incredible to watch.
Oh yeah.
Can I ask you about a movie you didn't talk about?
Yeah, I mean, I have one more movie I'm going to talk about, but yes.
Oh, go ahead and talk about it, and then maybe it's the movie. I was going to ask about.
Anyway, yeah, so there's two more of those, and I will watch them and report back when I do. I'm not going to, like, watch all the trilogy in a go. Spread that out a little bit. The third movie I want to talk about was Sexy Beast, the 2000 Jonathan Glazer movie.
Oh, you did tell me I should watch that soon.
Yes, which is about Ray Winstone as a retired thief guy. who has just moved to Spain. He's like, I'm done, hung up the life. He moves to Spain. It opens with him just like in little tiny swim like speedos by his fucking pool in his like little shitty estate in the middle of nowhere. And like a boulder rolls down the hill and almost kills him. And he's like, damn, that could wipe me out. It lands in his pool. He's got to get his pool fixed. A fucking boulder, a Spanish boulder, just like almost crushed him. And he's being called back for one last job as Ben Kingsley shows up as the like psycho guy in any one of these. You know, the guy who's like, well, we can't get rid of him because he'd murder us all, but and he's useful. But so I guess we're gonna keep him around even though everyone's terrified of him. That's who Ben Kingsley is. And he's like, you need to come back to London. We got one more job, and I know you're just the man. And it's like, do you really think I'm just the man? Because I haven't done a thing in 10 years, or you just want to fuck my wife? Because I know that you two had a thing back in the day. Just pure like gangsters who are over it shit, which is I know Jackson's wheelhouse, which is why I was like, you gotta watch this one.
Yeah, it is.
It's really good.
It sounds really good.
I genuinely think this is like the best British crime film I've ever seen. I think it's incredible.
Now, while I believe you, I do have to say, as a genre, that's not like a high...
No, I know. It's a genre regard. I don't particularly like, is the thing. It's like, I think this is number one. I think Mona Lisa's number two. I think In Bruges is number three. I think that would be my rating.
Ooh,
I do fucking like In Bruges. I haven't gone back and rewatched it since I was a teenager. Other than like,
yeah,
I mean,
I haven't watched it since my 20s, so, you know.
But I do hold a like belief in my heart that I bet it holds up. That's just a thing that I believe.
Same. Yeah. I'm with you there.
So that's my pitch for Sexy Beast. It's also on Criterion right now. They have a Jonathan Glazer set of movies since he won the Oscar.
I think they are doing that before the Oscars hit, but before the Oscars they had him. Okay, so the movie I wanted to ask you about, I can't remember the title off the top of my head. I want to say it was the Herzog movie that I was sitting in the room you were watching.
Oh, Fata Morgana. Yes, I watched. Yeah, so I watched Herzog's 1971, I don't think I'll call it a documentary, film, Fata Morgana, in which he, the movie is like a narrator telling a Mayan creation myth over footage of the African desert. But like where the desert interfaces like human society, like villages and like crashed airplanes, and just like dead herd animals, like mummified just by being in the desert when they fall over dead. And just as a meditation on life and death more than anything. It's not really about society in any way. Turns out this is supposedly this is like one of his early foundational movies, and people, it's very influential. I didn't know. I just picked it off my Herzog set, popped it in. Had no idea. What would you like to ask about it?
Oh, no. I just wanted to ask your thoughts on it, because every time I looked up, something ridiculous was happening, or there was a dead animal on screen. Like, there was a scene where this guy was just holding a plant. Or no, he's talking about plants, and then he just holds up a plant after he's done talking about the plant.
Yeah.
And, like, they're out in this, like, craggy mountainous area, and, like, then there was, like, random guys in caves, and it just looked like an art film, like a hella capital A, capital F art film, and I just wanted to know what you thought of
it. So, originally the thing with that was that Herzog was going to do a sci-fi movie where he shot it all in the desert and just, like, did a narrative over it as like, we came to this strange planet and look at what we found, as like, oh, like aliens came, or we came to another Earth that was like desolate and like the civilization collapsed, and then realized you didn't even need the sci-fi conceit. Like, it's just interesting enough on its own. And so it's just footage of the places and the people. And so, yeah, you get people like, you know, chilling in cars that have not started since the 1940s that are just like rusted out in the, like next to their house, and crashed airplanes. And there's this kid who has like a desert fox that he keeps as like a pet. There's just this German guy who like works at some sort of marine preserve, and it just shows him swimming with sea turtles in like the zoo.
Yes.
Yeah.
He like pulls one up to talk about it, and it so doesn't want to be in his arms.
Yeah, he's just like a tubby little man with a walrus mustache. He looks like Jamie Hyneman from Mythbusters, but he's in like a wetsuit with flippers as he's doing this. And then there's another like German guy who's like some sort of like clearly like a biologist who talks about, he's like, I've been in the desert for years because I want to study these Gila monsters, and they're only here, so I have to come here. And he's holding up this lizard to camera the entire time, like, look at this incredible creature. This is why I gave up my entire life, to see this thing. And juxtaposed with like just normal people living their lives and in their houses, and then also just like endless footage of like oil fields and desert dunes all put next to each other with this narrative of like, you know, this the creation of life, And I don't find much use personally in like doing a lot of meaning making watching films like this. I just kind of take it in and like I react to it and think about it. I think it's so much more intentional than Kanaskatsi is. I watched them like 2 weeks apart, so I didn't really think about them until you asked me about it right now. But it definitely kicks the shit out of that movie. I'll tell you what.
It looked really good. I want to watch it.
Kanaskatsi is like awe-inspiring. Like all the footage is incredible. It's like, man, this is just like, I understand why this is like buried itself in like cinematic history consciousness. There's like one shot that I just think is like breathtaking of like, it's just inside the backseat of a car at night. As these two guys are driving their car through the city, but it's all like hyper sped up time lapse of just like the neon streaks going past the car as they drive through the city. And it just looks like they're driving through like space time. And it's so incredible. It's just like breathtaking shot. Ooh. Fucking cinema. and Fata Morgana it's much more staid. You know, it's like, what if this is like the post-industrialization of Lawrence of Arabia, right? Like that is the romance of the dunes. But the reality is most of it's fucking trucks and storage and wreckage and people in villages who are poor, but they're make do because it's just the life they lead right next to each other. And I think that footage is also very good and interesting. Yeah, I liked it quite a bit.
Okay, cool. Thank you for talking about it.
Yep. A lot of movies lately.
You've been moving it like every night. You're like, I'm gonna watch a movie.
I mean, last 2 weeks I have not because I've just been kind of sick and out of it. But yes, I had been watching a lot of movies. Anyway, guess we'll get to it. Our movie club this week is Sullivan's Travels, a 1941 comedy written and directed by Preston Sturges. Destiny.
Yes.
You picked this, right?
I sure did.
Tell me why you picked it, and then Jackson will tell us what it's about.
Fuck! Okay. I thought I was like, wait, am I getting off the hook?
Good, because I don't remember very much.
Because we watched it 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, we watched it a long-ass time ago. Okay, so I picked this because I've always wanted to see it. It's just been one of those movies I've been hearing about it my whole life.
I'd never heard about it, but watching it, I was like, oh, this is the Coen brothers stole like 6 movies from this movie.
Yeah, they sure did. I remember seeing PBS had this very cool series about filmmaking that they would just randomly show that I was obsessed with as a high schooler. And they do an episode about noir and like snappy dialogue, and Sullivan's Travels comes up a ton. And I think they do talk about the Coens in that episode. I think that's what got me on my Coens path as a teenager, because I saw a lot of their stuff early. Anyway, so like, it's been a movie that I've just been wanting to see for decades at this point, and I was like, all right, finally, I have an excuse, let's watch it.
Jackson, what happens in this film?
This film is about a director, Sullivan. What's his actual full name?
John L. Sullivan.
John L. Sullivan, who is a director of fluffy comedies, and he decides he wants to...
He wants to discover the life of the mind.
He wants to discover the life of the mind. He wants to direct his next movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? By going on like a journey to understand the suffering of the working man.
Yes, this is in the middle of the Great Depression, pre-World War II.
Yes. What? It's... Okay, I guess it's technically pre-World War II for America.
Yeah, America was not involved. This is a very particular era of American history.
You say 1941, yes. I'm like, the middle of fucking World War II, and America's like,
we are not getting involved right now. We're actively not involved. Line
to like, oh yeah, war in Europe, and I'm like,
no, you know what pulled everyone Europe? Out of poverty? You know what the solution to all of our poverty was going to fucking war.
I mean, yeah, I did fucking, and you know, they never turned the machine off.
The defense
machine they turned on for World War II, just like, they were like, we don't want to stop. Can we have the Cold War and the Korean War? And then they were like, yeah, okay, sure. And then it was just never ended. So yes, very depressing. Yeah. Anyway, the movie. He wants to understand the suffering of the poor people so he can better make a movie that will like speak to the suffering of the people and not be like insulting fluff, disposable for the masses. And then goes upon this journey where he keeps trying to like... be with the poor people and just keeps coming back to Hollywood. He can't, like, leave.
I would watch the whole movie of that, to be perfectly honest. Yeah, like, I would watch like the first whole half movie of hour.
Yeah. But I did think, is the entire movie going to be him getting like two towns out and something causing him to come back to Hollywood? He runs into the girl, who is the contractually obligated like romantic interest in one of these movies, played by Veronica Lake. She's fantastic. She's like a poor aspiring actress who hasn't hit it, and as such, like, falls in with this director who's pretending to be a tramp, like in the fucking Chaplin style, right? Like, he's
literally... even more than that, he's like a fucking hobo, like a full-on, like, hopping on trains. I think this Dick is so Whitman. Different than the, like, little tramp guy to me.
Yeah, but that's the, like, inspiration.
Yeah, I was about to say, there's definitely some influence happening.
And is just mostly annoyed by him, but will, like, you know, hook up to him, and they, you know, they understand each other, but decides that she will join him on his, like, long odyssey across the country to try to actually get to know the poor people. After a lot of false starts, they finally get on with it, leave Hollywood properly. A bunch of episodes of ridiculous stuff happening, as they're, like, going to soup kitchens and sleeping with the homeless and, you know, sheltering in places. He, like, tries to thank the homeless with money, and then, like his clothes stolen. That homeless man gets run over by a train, so they can't identify him, but because his clothes were stolen, the, like, ID he had in his shoes is identified, and he is reported dead. When he wakes up, he just, like, attacks the guy that is trying to, like, wake him up.
Get him off the train,
kind of out
yeah.
of it. Get him off the train. He's kind of out of it. Yeah, it's like
he's lost his memory.
Guy.
Yeah.
He's lost his memory, and he has sent us to 6 years hard labor in the labor camps. Eventually remembers he's a rich person. He's like, I'm not allowed to be here. I'm not allowed to be in the labor camps. I'm a rich person. That's not me. And it briefly pretends like it might be about that. Then he figures out how to get out, and then he's finally like, what if I confess to my own murder? Then they'll let me out. And I'm like, that wasn't
actually
the crime.
Well, they'll put my picture in the paper, and then my rich friends will know that I'm telling the truth because they'll see me. Which is truly what happens.
Which is what happens. But it is presented completely uncommented upon, nothing to do with his noble journey. Like, it's not actually about that he cheated out of his consequences, where all the poor people have to actually go to prison.
I think it's a little bit about that. It doesn't really start
and
lampshade
it. It comes up a little bit, because he's like,
he
I am
just
guilty.
Like, get out of it. And the movie's like, that was good that he did that.
I mean, I think this movie expects the audience to understand he is being ridiculous and laugh at him when he does this.
Yes, but he mostly goes to the prison to watch them watch the movies, to watch them watch like a Disney film, and they're all laughing.
Yeah, it's a Pluto cartoon specifically.
And the Wikipedia page was like, this was meant to be a Chaplin film, but he wouldn't let us do it.
Yeah.
So he had to use a Disney film instead. I'm like, it would have made way more sense if it was a trap movie, because that's what the movie's about. But Disney film. And as he returns back to his life, says that he no longer wants to make a Brother Art Thou, because he's learned of the meaning of that, like, fluffy comedies have.
I think it makes less sense with the Chaplin movie, because the Chaplin movie, Chaplin is keenly aware of, like, the class structures in America and, like, both the humor and the nobility of being poor and sad. And Walt Disney's making fluff. I think it's better than its fucking Pluto
That's
cartoon.
That's true. It is just like a Pluto cartoon that has nothing to do with anything. Like, I would say the Chaplin movies are across the board much better than this movie about, like, the class.
I mean, Chaplin's one of my favorite filmmakers of all time, so that's unfair. I like this movie quite a bit, though.
Yeah, I thought it was okay, and then I thought the last 20 minutes were fucking terrible. And I was like, fuck it all, yeah. It's all about, look at all the poor people. Look at them crying in the Disney movie. Isn't it so noble? Because all Hollywood cares about is how important movies are. I was like, fuck off.
I think Preston Sturges is more aware of this stuff than you are giving him credit for. I think this
I think there's a lot of awareness happening, and I also feel like...
I thought it was completely straight at the end when all the, like, poor people are laughing at the movie.
But
go on.
The thing for me that I was really, like, I thought this was, like, shocking, and then I learned that he got an NAACP award about it specifically, is, so they're in the labor camp, because it's the 30s, sorry, the 40s, early 40s, the labor camp is, like... like mostly like white folks. There's a couple of black people there, but they specifically are given, like, as an act of charity from a black church nearby, are asked to come and join in the black church's movie night. And it's like a full black church, and there's like a sermon, and he's like, we're gonna have the prisoners come in, and they all marched in and they sit together, and the black characters are explicitly, like, not cartoonish, especially like juxtaposed against, there's a bit early on when they're in the like fucking tour bus that he's for his hobo tour across America, all of his publicists and shit get in the fucking hobo bus, and there's like a black cook chef. He's like the only black character, and there's literally an entire like insert shot of him in the kitchen as like kitchen implements fall on him, as like broad comedy that is really buying into like the racist caricatures of the 1940s. And it's so it's like 180 degrees from the church where they sing, they're just doing a hymn. They sing Go Down Moses as the prisoners are marched in chains, like chained together as like a chain gang to watch this movie. And the juxtaposition of like modern imprisonment as labor force versus a black church of people who are not, you know, they're just like normal black people singing about, you know, the song about both slavery and religious slavery in like Moses and letting his like freeing the slaves. I thought it was just like really progressive for Nathan. I was like, oh, it turns out NAACP gave an award for this exact scene. Like, just fucking wild that they did this.
You're not wrong, but I did like, I guess I just latched onto the fact that like it was the movies that did it was the thing that like really was like,
I understand what you're saying.
The lesson that it ultimately, like, I mean, this is, away.
I think like Sullivan's original point that the working man wants to be spoken to with like high art that like talks to his condition is so paternalistic and arrogant. That's the thing, is like he learns that, oh, I've been arrogant. People just want to fucking watch a movie sometimes.
Yeah, but this is a paternalistic movie about how the working people just want.
No, it's about like, how he's ridiculous. How this man is ridiculous and has to just learn making comedies is good sometimes. Like, I agree, you're like, a Hollywood man who's been successful. Count your blessings and shut the fuck up.
But I think this movie, it's then like, by taking on this grand journey about it, it just applies the preachiness to the idea that fluffy comedies will heal the societal wounds.
I don't think it will heal the societal wounds, but they do. When you have a bad day, it's nice to go home and laugh at some shit. That's fine. It's like, that is okay for art to aspire to.
I think it was healing anything. I think it was just saying that like this art does speak to the, you know, the masses in a way that is helpful to them, but I don't think it was saying this will cure all the ills. Just because like there's that scene where he has the where he's getting dressed up to be a hobo,
yes,
and the butler comes in and just like starts digging into him.
Yes,
yeah, that scene's great. Yeah,
yeah, and I think
I didn't, like, hate this movie or anything. Like, I'm not like that strongly against it. I just like. The stuff with the movie theater at the end and the big final monologue about like the importance of how the thing we can do to the poor is provide them relief through laughter. I was like, well, that's just as paternalistic as the thing you were doing at the start, but from the other angle, it's just saying that the fluff is also meaningful. But you've made a meaningful preachy movie, but you didn't make fluff. You made a meaningful preachy movie about you just kind of made.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Well, okay, so I'm going to talk about Woody Allen, just, you know, if you need to skip ahead. So Woody Allen made a movie in 82 called Stardust Memories about this, like, director who's kind of, played by himself, of course, who's just kind of, like, tired of making comedies and starts making, like, serious business movies. And at some point he gets visited by aliens and they, and like, the whole joke of the film is everybody keeps saying this line to him about, like, well, we liked your earlier, funnier movies. And he realizes at the end, it's kind of like Sullivan's Travels. He realizes at the end, like, the earlier, funnier movies are the thing that can, like, connect him to people. And I think that's what this movie is kind of saying. I don't think it's, like, I mean, overall paternalistic.
The part where he, like, oh, now that I've learned the play, the common man, I need to go and, like, thank them by giving them all $5. I'm going to walk around with $100 in my pocket, fives, hand them out to every guy on the street. That's the paternalism, and he gets fucking robbed for it. He almost dies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because one rich man cannot change this thing, right? He can just do the thing he does, which is make movies.
Mm-hmm. And then,
leave those,
like,
people alone.
Yeah. Exactly.
I do like, one of my favorite bits is that he gets in a fucking Grapes of Wrath, like, laborer situation where he's, like, working for this lady, but she's just, like, this, like, old widower who wants to fuck him constantly, and he literally has to, like, climb out the window in the middle of the night to keep her from fucking him.
The conversation she has with her sister when he's, like, in the house.
Oh, he's, like chopping wood, and it's, like, she's like, you know what I need? And she's like, yeah, I know what you need.
Yeah, that was great. Like, did you see his torso? I noticed you noticed it. Yeah, that was one of my favorite exchanges. There's a lot of good exchanges in this movie. Every time we talk to the execs and they're like talking about what they were doing when they were 25.
Oh, just lying? Just fucking lying?
Yeah, like when I was 13, I was supporting a family. And he's like, what were you? I was in boarding school. They were funny.
Yeah, I mean, partially because it's a riff on Gulliver's Travels, right? The name, which is so much. It is about like a guy goes through a bunch of societies and in doing so learns about himself. I think the point of the movie is on Sullivan getting over his own bullshit. Because there's a part where the girl comes in and looks at his house, and his house just has fucking columns. She's like, "You got a pool?" And he's like, "Yeah, of course I got a pool." They go out and it's this beautiful fucking pool on their poolside, and she's immediately like pissed at him that he would fucking dress in his homeless chic and then like hit her up at a diner. Like, how dare you do this when I literally is like spending my last dollar to get out of this awful town and you're like a guy who runs it. Fuck you.
Yeah. There was another scene. Oh, also the fact that it like takes this hard turn into like a really gruesome sort of like this is the reality of prison. Like that, if that all wasn't in the film, I would agree with Jackson more. Just the like,
I mean, I do think the prison stuff is like the weakest part of the movie.
It is.
I like the two of them and their like goofy like romance back and forth dialogue a lot. Anytime his butler and his valet show up, those characters, the best characters in the fucking world. That's a C-3PO to me, just like a stodgy, effeminate man who sucks. I love him. He's right all the time and no one listens to him.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that is a C-3PO.
I said I don't think the back third is like the strongest part of the movie.
The last line is almost cringeworthy in my opinion.
I don't think it's gonna beat the preachy allegations. I just think it's more than just that. I think there's stuff there.
Yeah.
I know it just didn't hit for me. I know it's like an old movie, right? Like I'm sure if I was watching other like actual trash from 1941, I'd be like, what the fuck is this garbage?
My other favorite, oh go on, sorry.
I didn't, I would, yeah, you go.
Oh, I was just gonna say my other favorite thing about this movie is the titles of all the fake movies in the, that's like my favorite thing in fiction is just when there's a fake movie title. Like I'm obsessed with the Seinfeld ones. But like Ants in Your Plants
of 1939, implying that there's been like four of them, which is the pure 30 studio Hollywood stuff to me.
Yes. Oh, I love that. Oh, Brother Where Art Thou? I get why the Coens stole that. That's a great movie title for that sort of thing. Oh, Brother Where Art Thou?
Also about this time of world and also a ludicrous comedy about like class and nonsense of culture. Oh, Brother Where Art Thou? A fucking classic. That's one of the great films.
Movie slaps.
We're in a tight spot.
Dapper Dan Man.
Dapper Dan Man. I don't want fop, damn it.
I do see why the like Coen brothers stole like basically this movie about six times, you know, like Barton Fink's all in here.
Barton Fink is about this exact thing from the, like the opposite direction of I want to write important scripts and everyone going, no, make fucking comedies, you idiot.
I really liked the girl, I guess. She's literally just called the girl in the credits.
She's just called the girl, yeah. It's weird because, like, when you read the stuff, it's like no one liked Veronica Lake, and she had a very sad life and stopped being popular because she was difficult to work with and was busy drinking herself to death during all of this. And that sucks because she's fucking great in this movie. The poster is just like her, like a caricature of her, and it's great.
Yeah. Like, internationally, too. Like, most of the movie posters, because I looked, they're all her. It's really sad that she didn't really get to do more because she's excellent. She's my favorite part of this movie.
Yeah, she's killing it. And I tend to like this in old movies when there's like, 30s and 40s romances or that are just people kind of talking and being sad at each other and needling each other. I always love that. It's a vibe that I'm very much into. And it's great here, as it usually is.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's all really good.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I also like, what's that? What is that movie we watched, Destiny? What about the couple who sell their house? What's the name of that movie?
Oh, Lost in America. America. Yeah, Lost I was going to bring that up too. Yeah. The Lost, like when there was a point where I just turned to you and I said, this is just Lost in America.
Yeah, the Albert Brooks movie Lost in America about yuppies who decide to, we're going to RV across the world, like country, and discover ourselves through like enforced poor. They want to do an Easy Rider. They're like, oh, we're going to be like Easy Rider with our $145,000 nest egg from when we sold our house. Is just one of these of like the story of rich people trying to like do poor chic as like an affectation. Classic of cinema. That movie's great. Yeah. It's an Albert Brooks film. Love it. If you can find it, watch it. It's very funny.
Yeah, it's great.
Because people still love to be poor chic all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, never goes out of style.
Changed. That's not changed.
Nope.
No.
They're still making TV shows about, I lived in X situation for like a week. And everyone goes, well, that's great, man. I'm sure you really understand the plight of being poor. Fuck off.
I'm undercover, boss. Undercover boss. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, rich people love to think they're just like you as they put on their like torn jacket with like no sleeves as they go to like walk past their pool. Yeah, and they're like Greek plinths.
The Beyonce country album came out yesterday, and yeah, there's a lot of songs about her like working 9 to 5, and I'm like, oh, Beyonce, you have not done
Beyonce,
that
you have not worked
16.
9 to 5. Yeah, exactly.
That's weird. I didn't know that happened. Not to distract this movie podcast. Yeah. So I'm like, that's
not that Beyonce. Making music isn't labor, Beyonce, but it's not the same thing. You are not the common man. You haven't been the common man since the 90s. Come on.
And barely so.
Yes.
Pretty big in the 90s.
Yeah.
Why would you make that pivot? Like, her entire career has been on, like, marketing herself as, like, bigger than the common man. Because
she's making
right?
a country album, and that's what country music's about.
She's also...
Weird pivot.
Well, it's not weird pivot, because she... Okay, so she got, booed at the Country Music Awards when she performed
with
the chicks.
Well, they're fucking racist. That part is less surprising to me.
And this was her, clapback to that specific incident. Like,
okay.
The album, the first single of the album, literally is her saying in the lyrics, I was unwelcome there, and now I'm taking up this space. And I'm
also bringing more sense.
The entire history of black country music with me.
I was not up to date on the culture war that was leading to this. I was just like, that's not really what Beyonce's brand is.
Her brand has lately been in the sonic experimentation wheelhouse, which is very interesting to me, even though I don't really like country music.
When I think of Beyonce Brown, black woman icon, like superstar, but in a mythical figure type sense is how I feel like she has marketed herself.
Yeah.
I would argue that this is still in that mode.
Okay.
Excuse me. Oh, yeah,
I literally just discovered it. As you said, I was like, what's going on?
you didn't see the 8,000 tweets of literally everyone we know listening to her 2-hour fucking album yesterday?
No, I was asleep or busy or something. On British time.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry about the Beyonce tangent. It just reminded me of.
No, it's fine. Does anyone have anything else? Because probably.
Yeah. I feel like I came across more. I thought it was funny. Less fun than I expected. It was a lot of him kind of going around being poor, which is not, famously not funny. I just kind of didn't like how it all came together, but it's not like I it's not one of the 30s classics that I really hate. It's not like It Happened One Night, which I think is fucking terrible. Which I watched recently and was like, I'm fucking, well, it's fucking
seen,
bad.
I haven't seen that since I was fucking 20. So I have no idea how I feel about it.
Mm. I watched it a couple years ago. I actually don't remember when it was.
I feel like most of my favorite screwball comedies are all workplace comedies. It's all the Hepburn Tracy sort of stuff.
I was watching it when I was going through some of my 30s movies, and I watched My Man Godfrey at a similar time, which is another class comedy, but he's a butler, right? So there's a lot of more workplacey stuff.
Yes.
I would like to see that.
I like that one. That one's a good fun.
Oh, wait. Is that Rita Hayworth? I think I have seen that movie.
No.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
No.
My bad. Thinking of a different movie.
Anything else?
Not particularly.
I don't really really have anything.
All right. If you'd like to send in emails, you can send them to abnormalmappingpodcast@gmail.com. They can be about any movie stuff. We prefer when they are, because I know, you know, we don't get a lot of questions about the actual movies because we pick kind of weird, not obscure movies, but movies people aren't talking about. So send them in. Our first one's from Crystal, because Crystal asked last time, do we have any favorite movies about Islam? And I was like, I don't know any movie about Islam. A good movie about Islam, and perhaps the movie that is most about Islam, is The Message, 1976, directed by Mustafa Akkad, also known as the producer of the Halloween films. It's a three-hour epic that deals the story of the early days of Islam. He produced two versions simultaneously with different cast, one filmed in Arabic and another filmed in English, which is always fascinating.
I want to track that down.
Yeah. Aiden writes in, last night I had a dream that Sergio Leone did a second version of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly that was exactly the same, except they filmed the whole thing underwater. In the same locations, but flooded. The guns and stuff still worked, but everyone was slower. What movie should be remade exactly the same, but underwater? To which I go, have you seen Thunderball? No movie is better underwater. Underwater ruined cinema.
Thunderball's so boring! Oh,
and it's
God,
all because of the fucking underwater stuff. It's just, it's too hard to shoot underwater.
Right,
because
it's the director of the Good Bomb movies at the time, right? It's the guy that did From Rush with Love and Dots and
Oh, yeah, and then, like, I mean, if you watch Never Say Never Again, which is a kind of a soft remake of Thunderball, it's made by What's-His-Face, who did Empire Strikes Back. I don't remember his name off the top of my head. Right after Empire Strikes Back, that's why he didn't direct Return of the Jedi. And it also has a bunch of underwater shit, and it ruins the film.
Ivan Kershner's funny because you can also say the director of RoboCop 2 and then he looks less impressive.
Okay, well, whatever. Never Say Never Again, I think, is a pretty good movie, except for the part where it's all half of it's underwater and you're like, fuck this, this is boring.
Anyway, pick a movie. The 40-Year-Old Virgin.
That would be very, very funny.
I don't know why I'm afraid that way, but what if that was underwater? I guess
David Lynch's Dune.
Oh, that would be funny.
I just want a movie that's about people talking about how dry everything is, but it's underwater. Not mentioned once.
I almost mentioned that. Yeah, they don't talk about it at all. They're just underwater, incidentally. For some reason, I couldn't get over the mental image of, like, a car movie underwater, so my pick is Death Proof. Like, I'd love to see, like, a Death Proof style chase, like, underwater. I don't know why that's, like, really funny to me.
Yeah.
So that's my pick.
Waterworld, that's a good pick. Dryland is a myth.
Wait, so it's the same as Waterworld, but they're also underwater? So
they're also underwater, being like, oh, we need to find dry land. And then when they get to spoilers for Waterworld, they get to some dry land at the end of that movie, but it's also underwater. Stupid. We should do Waterworld for Blockbuster sometime.
Yeah, probably. We probably.
I remember really liking Waterworld.
Postman. Have you done the Postman?
I don't want to do the Postman. No, we have not done the Postman. We're gonna do a Kevin Costner messy giant epic. I want to do Waterworld instead.
Okay. It's probably the better choice, to be honest.
We should be, if we're doing a Kevin Costner messy giant epic, we should be doing JFK.
That's different. We will do JFK at some point, but that's not a Kevin Costner vehicle. That's an Oliver Stone nightmare. different category.
They're opposites on the wheel.
They're not opposites, but one supersedes the other for sure.
You would get like a little, not electric shock, but you'd get a little taken back if someone described JFK as a Kevin Costner epic.
Yes. Yes, I'm like, Field of Dreams is a Kevin Costner epic, not fucking JFK.
You see them putting out a fucking two Kevin Costner Western epics in like 2 months?
No, I did not.
And then part two, one and two of an intended four also.
Oh my God.
Because he's been like, oh, I wanted to make this four-part Western epic of America. And he somehow got Warner Brothers to let him make two parts back-to-back. And I guess if they do well, he'll do part three.
It'll be really good when they delete part three and four for tax reasons.
I assume this is him building off of the goodwill of that show that everyone watches, but isn't like, but no one who's online, right? The one that's,
I have
like,
no idea what show you're talking about.
Yeah, okay. Yellowstone. That what it is?
I believe so.
I believe that's the Western show.
Yeah, Yellowstone. It's like 5 seasons long, makes $1 million bajillion, most successful show on TV.
Never heard anyone talk about it.
It's all like offline dads who watched it, so
yeah. I don't hear old people talking about it. No offense, old people, but you'll watch it. You watch that stuff.
Joey writes in, ever since watching The Matrix Revolutions for the first time, I've never stopped mixing cookie dough with my hands because the Oracle says to Satie, cookies need love like everything does. Have you ever developed a benign, maybe weird habit or learned something cool that has been applied to your everyday day-to-day life routines due to seeing or learning about them from a movie or TV show or other media? Signed, Joey, coming up on 10 years of Greatest Gamer. Congratulations to Joey.
Not to my knowledge. Maybe I have, but I have so many other weird just like OCD quirks from my own brain, right? Because I have various afflictions of the mind.
Show you the life of the mind.
I'm seeing the life of the mind. Well, it's just that when people say like, oh, OCD quirks, you know, you just expect them making it up because it just became like a thing people said, but I do actually have it and it sucks. It's fucking bad.
I think I have more of things I say because of movies than I do behaviors.
That's true.
Oh, sorry. When I was in 8th grade, very young, because I was watching a lot of stuff on TV, and I saw The Graduate for the first time, and there's a scene where they're eating burgers very fast. Like, it's when he goes on the date with, oh my god, why can't I think of her name? Elaine? And
sure, whatever.
They're just eating the burgers. Like, it's not commented upon. But they're just eating them so fast. And there was a phase where I would just eat burgers like that. Whenever I had burgers and fries, I would just eat like that. Because I saw it in The Graduate. It's very weird. I don't understand me.
I have one where, like, I just think the movie's wrong. There's a bit at the end of the first Hellboy movie where Jeffrey Tambor is like, because Hellboy smokes cigars, he lights it with like a Zippo. He's like, no, you don't use a lighter, you use a match. It preserves the flavor. And I was like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, Jeffrey Tambor, you're full of shit. Someone likes cigars. This is the most affectation thing you could say in the world.
Why would it? It's just an open flame, right? There's no possible way it can make a difference.
No. No, I know. Also, nobody uses a Zippo for a cigar. I mean, using a Zippo, it'd take forever to light a cigar. You use a fucking torch, like a butane torch. Everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I do have to roast you for being snobby about cigars on this podcast.
I'm being anti-snobby about cigars. Jeffrey Tambor is being snobby about cigars. I'm telling you, it doesn't matter how you light a cigar. Enjoy your fucking cigar.
But having an opinion on the correct way to engage with a cigar is itself a snobby thing to do. It doesn't matter which way direction you go. You're engaging in the snobby arena of culture.
You don't fucking know. You've never smoked in your life.
I'm not taking advice from you.
I've only had a cigar once. It made me so nauseous I'll never have one again.
Well, you don't fucking inhale the cigar.
I didn't inhale it. It was just like smoking it regular. I didn't inhale it because I knew you weren't supposed to inhale it. I still got so nauseous I thought I was going to yak.
Yeah, I don't know.
It was just too much for me.
Okay. Did you have an answer? Destiny, you said an answer for this?
Oh, no, just my dumb graduate thing.
Oh, okay, okay.
Oh, I guess I do, I can finally think of one that actually kind of makes up, which is also a Matrix thing, which is my phone. When I got phones, because I got phones too late, like I was getting my first mobile phone in like 2005, 2006, I was so mad that I could never like answer the phone like near where he just kind of like shakes it open.
Oh, yeah.
But he's just like running and shaking. Mobile phones couldn't do that by that point. And yeah. I would just like be pressing a button on my shitty Nokia brick phone. So I wasn't able to make it a habit, but I always thought about that with phones.
That's fair. I guess the only one, like, I've talked about this before, but I don't like looking in mirrors twice because of horror movies, because the second time you look is when a thing's behind you.
Oh, yeah.
I still don't like doing that.
Bloody Mary will be there.
Yeah, you never know. Some fucking ghost is going to be behind you.
Yeah. It's true.
Yeah.
I bet I have more of these. That was the only thing I could think of.
Yeah. Tron writes in, what are your favorite bits of physical comedy in the movie?
I mean, everyone falling into the swimming pool like 17 times.
I like the chase, even though they had the Reese's bit, like I liked all, because the way that's filmed is just really neat for that era. Like it just looked really cool.
Oh, when he gets that fucking little kid's car.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed that.
He's like, I'm off to school. God. I think my favorite one is the two of them trying to hop on the train and just being like fully unprepared for what it takes to get on a train, and it takes them literally forever.
The bit where the actual homeless guys are watching them spend like,
yes,
45 full seconds trying to get on the train.
Yes. What are your favorite comedy films that are about something serious?
I like Dr. Strangelove. I know nobody here likes Dr. Strangelove, but I love Dr.
Failsafe
Strangelove.
Gang. This post made by Failsafe Gang.
Yeah, we're Failsafe Gang.
I haven't seen it, so that, forgive me.
The Guard? Can I shout The Guard?
You've been trying to get me to watch The Guard for about a decade.
It's good.
Harold and Maude.
Yeah, yeah, that's totally solid.
Yeah, it's about death.
Yeah, I guess I don't know. Everything can be serious. It's all in how you take it.
Yeah, it's like obviously most comedies I watch, I guess, but that's not like necessarily true. I guess I do also like fluffy comedies. I wouldn't say like The Blues Brothers is about anything serious.
That's true. Young Adult. Young Adult is
Young Adult's on my list for sure.
Yeah. Oh, Young Adult rules.
Like we did The Apartment. I guess that's one of those.
The Apartment for gets sure. very serious for sure. Mm-hmm. Classic film.
I feel like there's a big one I'm overlooking.
Playtime. Playtime is... serious is not the wrong word. Existentially dreadful is up there. I would describe the situation in Playtime is hell. Being in hell. What if hell is a mall? And you're like, oh, all malls are hell, but there's no more malls, so hell's over.
It is funny that Playtime shows a terrifying vision of modernism that's already dead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's been fucking 70 years. You're allowed.
Yeah.
All right, that's it again. abnormalmappingpodcast@gmail.com. Next time we are watching Rome Open City, which I've always wanted to see, the Rossellini movie. Is that because I was watching Isabella Rossellini do her animal things a little bit? Kind of, actually. There's a bit where she's talking about, she was like, I never wanted to be a director. But I had this opportunity to make these things, and I was like, sure, I guess. How hard could it be? She's like, I never wanted to make a thing like my dad. And it cuts to her dad, fucking Rossellini, where it took dozens of people. But I was like, if it's like five people, I could do that. She was like, I had to get over some of the things that I'd grown up with, because my dad thought that moving the camera was like immoral, because cameras have to be locked. Because if you move the camera, you're instilling a narrative into your footage. And then she's like, and then I married Martin Scorsese, who makes a lot of big, beautiful, amoral movements.
That's such a, I will never understand specifically the moral stand for neorealists for making moving the camera, keeping the camera still is also a choice. They're both choices.
I understand it in a way in which you've watched like early cinema, like, you know, Soviet montage, like the idea of the cameras being a vehicle for statement fall apart and then go, we have to go the other direction. I totally get it as an overcorrection.
As long as
they're making movies like literally after the war, they're like, we get to redefine our nation's art output. Post all being destroyed in a war.
I get that, and I get the like intent of it. It's the specific part of like moving the camera is authorial, like in intervention. Keeping it still is not. I'm like, well, but yes. they're both making a choice. They're both an active choice.
You're not wrong. Yeah.
I highly recommend listening to Isabella Rossellini talk about it in her thing about why she's made all these films. That's all. Mm. It was cool. But I always want to see Rome Open City. I assume it's easily gettable because it's one of the fucking classics of film. It's about, you know, World War II and Rome.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
That'll be it. We'll be back in 2 weeks, hopefully, with no other interruptions. Destiny, where can people find you?
At Fridge Buzz now, most places.
Jackson.
You can find me at Headfalls Off on Twitter and Blue Sky and co-host, mostly Twitter, sometimes co-host, very occasionally Blue Sky. And you can find the podcast we do at abnormalmapping.com.
You can find me on Twitter at @EM_being. I'm not really posting anywhere else these days. If you'd like to support our work, you can do that at patreon.com/normalmapping. For $1 a month, you get the Great Gundam Project. We're currently finishing Gundam 00, and then we'll be watching some SD stuff, and then we'll be watching Gundam Unicorn. For $5, you get Blockbusters. We recently watched Stargate. We're about to watch Kingdom of Heaven, Director's Cut. whatever. Look forward to that. $10 you get VoIP Life, which has mostly been actually the most recent episode's about internet being online, being a person online, and Twitter and posting and all sorts of is good. Northern Lion comes up. We have a good time with that. If you'd like to hear me talk about movies, listen to Alf Around the Long Fire every Tuesday. That's going to be a Tuesday podcast now. I'm roadmapping.com/longfire. It's about classics. We're starting La Mort d'Arthur, but we do talk about movies pretty frequently. That'll be everything. So until next time, movies.
Now more than ever.
Don't expect to like them.